Hey, real quick, if you're a business owner that wants to stand out in the market and expand your customer base, I'd love to send you a copy of my free ebook. Visit our website at danielleclark.uk to get your copy now, or follow the link in the show notes. Welcome to Build Better Brands. I'm Danielle Clark, and this show is here to provide insights, techniques, and strategies to help you establish a better brand with confidence and clarity. We're on a mission to help as many people as possible start and build stronger brands so they can create happier, healthier lives for themselves and those around them. Welcome to another episode of Build Better Brands. Today, I'm joined by Simon Dixon. For those of you that don't know Simon Dixon, that are in the branding world, where are you? But for those of you that aren't in the branding world, well, Simon is co-founder of Dixon Baxi, which is a global agency that's worked with some pretty awesome clients like AC Milan and Warner Brothers, Google, Samsung, to name a few. And Simon has been kind enough to jump on today and have a conversation with us to talk about branding and brand thinking and design and the impact that design really has on the world. So welcome to the show, Simon.
Thanks, Danielle. It's super nice to be here, and thanks for that lovely introduction. I'm excited to have a chat.
Yeah, I'm really excited too. Obviously, we've been having conversations on LinkedIn and messaging, and I always think it's nice to actually have conversations with people that are very much like-minded in some respects. And you've built up this agency over the past 20 odd years. So I thought, why not? Let's get Simon on. Let's pick his brain a little bit and get into it. But first, I just want to ask Simon, and this is a tough question, but what does brand mean to you?
Bang, straight in. No softball questions.
No.
It's an excellent question because it means a lot of things to a lot of different people. I think historically people get a little caught up or confused between identity and the design aspect of branding, and branding conceptually in terms of what it means as a whole. And basically branding is people's relationship with the company, the benefits of the service or the product, or the business's relationship with them. So it's very much about perception, relationship, how the experiences of the brand show up in the world to create that relationship with people. And, you know, usually it's based on something that is a truth strategically in terms of what it does for people. And the closer that truth to the reality, the better. Because if you move into marketing where you basically say something that is beyond the truth of the brand, it's very easy to disconnect and people can spot that disconnect. But if you get to a point where people understand the relationship, the value of what the brand does for them, how it fits into their lives, their lifestyles, and the way they see the world, you can have a very close relationship. And of course, branding now is an interconnected ecosystem. It's the design and the semiotics of the visual aspect of it, of course, but it's what it represents in terms of the product and service. It's how it talks. It's how you interact with it. It might have an audible signature. It's in the real world, but it's also highly digital. It's part of social conversations. So all of those things have to work together to kind of create a connected journey for people, because people will enter brands at different points. You might come through your mobile. You might go into a store. You might just hear about a brand, you know, so certain brands, let's say Uber, you're more likely to have heard about Uber before you saw an ad or something else. And that transfer of the anecdote of what Uber does for you and brings a car to your door instantly is the first thing that starts to build that relationship. And when you click on the app and it happens instantaneously and you feel safer and it gets you where you're going and you know how long it'll take, that's another part of the brand. Obviously, the color of that, the way it interacts and whether or not it works, that's another part of it. And then when you get to advertising and the website and various other things, that's another part of it. So it's an interconnected entity, but it's representing the perception and the value and the benefit of what the brand does and how it builds that relationship with you based on what you need from it.
Yeah. And one of the things you said there really stood out to me was when you talked about truth, when brands aren't true, they get spotted, don't they? And the fact that, especially I think in this day and age, I think it's a lot more difficult to hide that.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly. Yeah.
in the past, brands could say all sorts of things in advertisements, which were often either in newspaper or TV adverts when things came out. But now brands are so visible that they can't really hide anywhere. So that aspect about the truth, I think, is really, really important, especially with the rise with social media. One brand that really stands out to me that has been quite transparent and has used their kind of mess up as leverage is KFC. When KFC ran out of chicken and everyone went crazy because they had to go Burger King, other fast food outlets are available, they leveraged that and turned their mess up into something positive because there was absolutely no hiding from it. Do you think more brands are being true to their values and true to the promise that they're making? Do you think they're trying to be?
Yeah, it depends what true means in a sense. So if you take something like a KFC, or mayonnaise, its job is to taste nice. You know, it's supposed to taste nice. And it probably needs to be at a price point that's worth buying. And there's a certain amount of ease to that and ubiquity. But you're buying it for the taste of the seasoning and what it feels like. The fact that the brand is confident not to apologize for that it's fried chicken is one of its strengths. That's what's cool about it. It's like, it is what it is. If it's another type of brand, say Patagonia, there's a greater truth because they're talking about a cycle of how you create products and its effect on the world. So, you know, we have a McDonald's at the end of our street, and McDonald's is great. It's fast, it's cheap, it's tasty. Everybody has had a McDonald's burger. But perpetually, there's motorbikes going in and out, or mopeds going in and out of there to deliver things to people two streets away. There's litter everywhere. So there's kind of two truths. There's a truth which is, what does the brand do for you? And in that moment when someone is eating a burger, they're really happy to forget all the negatives. When you get to something like Patagonia, people look at all the positives, which is, you know, the way they upcycle things, the way they have a kind of very considered approach to their footprint in the world, how they look after people. So it depends on the brand and where it is in your mindset, because we're all basically complicit in that truth. You know, we're all part of that change. So you make decisions based on your particular truth and moral compass and things like that. I do believe, though, you're right. Brands are being held more accountable, but I think also people are being held more accountable. It still doesn't stop people being weird and negative, but I think there is a kind of more open perception. What you've got to be careful of is people cheating that, because when you get to marketing, which is different to brand building, you can say a lot of things which, in a sense, cover up for the things I'm talking about. So if McDonald's shows a beautiful cow on a hill, I'm not sure that is exactly how the process works. And I know from the corner of my street that's not the effect on me. But I do like the fact that I can get burgers for 99 cents if I'm hungry. So you kind of have to figure out the balance of those two. And I think we'll all have like 20, 30 brands in our lives that we go to regularly for information services, things that we wear, that we like. And what they are is they're identifiers of who we are, our tribe, and what we believe about our footprint and culture and the way we carry ourselves in the world. And that relationship, I think, is where brands can either decide to serve people or not. And it's up to us to decide if that's the case.
I think that's really important. And it's almost like there's always two sides, isn't there? And it's not black and white, but like lots of things, you will gravitate towards the brands and organisations that speak to your inner monologue and your values about what you believe to be true and right and the way things are done. I want to talk a little bit about your business, Dixon Baxey. You started Dixon Baxey with your co-founder, Apoorva. The thing I wanted to talk about is this list. I've seen this list knocking about quite a lot, and I've noticed it's also in your, got this is like essentials booklet that's come out. Yeah. So can you tell us about this list of do's and don'ts that you and Apoorva put together and how Dixon Baxey kind of came about?
Yes. Well, we started the agency, like you said, more than two decades ago. So in a sense, it's a mature company. And Apoorva and I had worked together for many years before that, building studios and doing lots of fun work around the world, particularly in the US and the UK. And when we started the agency, we wanted to go back to something simpler, a bit more selfish and a bit more kind of refined how we wanted to create, because it was a kind of pivotal stage of our career. And it obviously was something new, so we could build it in a different way. And the do's and don'ts were almost things we'd learned that were good to do and not to do. So a greater degree of transparency and honesty, reduction of bullshit and the kind of crap that comes with our industry, trying to push ourselves to do a higher order of work and hold ourselves to a higher standard in terms of the creativity we create. Not working with toxic people or not working with certain types of companies we don't believe in. So it just became a kind of raison d'etre. And we've always believed that we run the company on principles and an ethos rather than technologies or what people tell us we should do or a particular playbook. We like it to be value and principle based because those things have longevity. And when things are difficult, it gives you something to hold on to. And when things are good, it gives you a platform to lift off. It gives you great strength. And so the essentials book you're talking about is, in a sense, is what we do. Who we do it for, how we do that, what we care about, our values, and the kind of habits and behaviors we think fulfill that and make the working environment positive, the work that we create positive, and push us to be creatively more beneficial and at the edge of where our industry is, so that we're constantly self-learning. Because when you've worked for any length of time, it's very easy to get knocked about by what's going on in the world and think you should do this and you should do this and you should do this. And it's incredibly draining mentally. Whereas if you have something in the middle that says, this is what we believe is our creativity, you can add things to that, new technologies or ways of working or things you learn, you know, remote working or whatever that thing is, you can add those things and then continue. So it just gives us raison d'etre, our strength of purpose, really.
It's a bit like a Bible, isn't it, by the sounds of things?
It is. I'm an atheist, so that bit of it doesn't actually work, but it's let's call it a playbook.
Okay, playbook. That's fine too. One of the things you said there, which I thought was really interesting, was being selective about who you work with and not working with organisations and businesses that don't align with your values and that are toxic. Because at some stage, and I think this happens with a lot of people, with a lot of organizations, you get to the point where you're kind of ticking along at the start, things are going well, you've got a few clients under your belt, business is like this, especially in the early days, right? And for those that can't see, it looks like I'm doing a bit of a dance move with my hand, but yeah, it's very up and down. And it's also about making profit, right, and making money. Have there ever been, and obviously share as much or as little as you want, but have you ever been in a situation where someone, an organisation or a business has come along that actually has been worth a significant amount, but they were so not aligned with your values and the things that you stand for that you've actually walked away? And has that impacted? Okay.
Yeah, we do it regularly. The thing to say is there's a number of reasons that we might or might not work with people. So obviously there's certain companies. So let's just say gambling or petrochemicals or tobacco or far right wing organizations. We wouldn't work with those for an obvious reason. Then there might be cultural differences, the way the company works, the type of work they need. But then there's also our fit for what they do. So we're not necessarily a good creative fit for every company. So it's in a sense, it's a curation at the extremes. It's types of businesses that we wouldn't work for kind of moral or personal reasons. And then it moves into practical things like cost, timings, location, things like that. Then it moves into things like, are we a good fit for them? That type of thing. So it's a kind of mix of things. It's not any one thing. And over history, we've had lots of periods where, like one period we were very, very busy, but the work was not good enough. It was a bit mediocre. It was repetitive. And we kind of lost our way creatively. So we resigned a few projects, turned things away and created space to do other things. So that was a kind of creative feeling that we liked the organizations and the people we were working with, but the work wasn't fulfilling enough. We worked with a very large gambling organization about 12 years ago. And initially we were, wow, this is like, it's a huge company. They're going to pay us a lot of money. It's a rebrand. It's really exciting. And then we were inside it and we were like, wow, this doesn't work. It's like we were looking at how they were, all the data they had relative to the person who's gambling. We thought, this process is never going to work for people. So we backed away from that and that industry. And then recently we've turned down lots of companies which, I don't know, they might be from places which culturally don't align with our beliefs and types of organizations. I wouldn't want to name any because it's a very personal thing. And I think it's important not to judge what other people do.
Of course.
So, for example, I drink alcohol. So it was wrong of me to say to somebody, well, I drink alcohol, but you're working on KFC and you're working on cigarettes. All of them have good and bad to them. So I think it's just, it ends up being either a personal or a team choice to decide what things you work on. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier, that the margins of that get softer in a sense. It's not black and white. I'm very careful not to, I don't want to judge how other people create and do what they do because they've all got their own perspectives. But yeah, we do, and we turn large amounts of money down in order to do that, and small amounts sometimes.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, when we were talking about truths. So you've got this, what did we call it? Not Bible, playbook.
Playbook.
We've got this playbook with these do's and don'ts. And it
Yeah.
sounds like they're not just staying on paper or put away somewhere. You're actually trying to live and breathe them, which I think is, when I look around, not a lot of businesses really do that.
Yeah, I don't know how it works elsewhere. I mean, some of our clients definitely do, some of the organizations we work with really live their principles. For us, it's a tested thing because we're constantly learning. So, we've made many, many mistakes along our journey, and we've had to grow and develop in terms of how we see the world. Certainly, compared to when I entered the industry or started this company and things like that, things have radically changed. So, we have like a set core principles, but they're constantly being refined and adapted to based on how culture and behaviors and the world and technology and people change. Because obviously, in 2024, it's very different to 20, well, 2004, for example. So, let's say 20 years ago. There's a many, many different things. So we see it as a kind of, we have this idea of always in beta where we're constantly just questioning each little thing we do. So it's a little refinement of each thing. It's like creativity, the culture with which we work, the processes with which we work, who we work with, and the output of that. And you keep, it's like whack-a-mole, you keep going along, whacking each one. So it's a bit, so it's constant refinement.
Yeah, which is what brand is. Brand is, I was having a conversation with someone the other day. When people say, "Oh yeah, I've had my brand done and that's done now," and it's like, well, actually, it's never done. Like ever, you have to continuously manage and nurture and review in order to make sure that it's still aligned with the goal and the direction that you want to go in. Has there been a key moment then in the Dixon Baxter journey where things have significantly, something's really shifted? The direction that you decided to take, or the approach that you have to branding. I know, obviously, you touched on, working with a really big gambling company and deciding that wasn't the thing that you wanted to do. But has there been anything else that's made you go, actually, no, this is the direction that we need to go in?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. They're not necessarily always large things. They're just an aggregation of a particular feeling or a niche that you get. A lot of it's down to wanting to the work to keep pushing us, so we feel like we're developing and we're remaining relevant and useful to people. But also, there's a basic thing when you're a designer or creator of just like being proud and loving the work. And is it cool? And is it something that you're into? So it's looking for that feeling of like, does it feel like work that is valuable and interesting and exciting and you're proud of it, and you get a buzz from doing it, and you get a buzz from making something that works for people. Because we obviously work at a scale where tens and hundreds, if not billions of people interact with what we create. So it has to work. But yeah, I always think of it as a feeling. I can kind of feel it. And then the other part of that is how people feel making it. So, how the team feels, their creative journey, the space that we create for them to develop, that's a big part of our job. And that's a creative process as well, because people need validation, a sense of place, personal ownership, share of voice. But at the same time, you're a team, so it's about how the team succeeds. So there's a lot of moving parts to that. So there's a constant balance between those two things, the work we make and how we work as a team, and then the processes in a sense support that.
I mean, one thing I notice about Dixon Baxi and especially the team is the diversity as well. It looks like to me that that is really important to your culture and the way that you do things, and especially with creative thinkers. Okay, people have lots of opinions and ways and perspectives of doing things, and that obviously contributes to the creative process. But how do you take all those perspectives and all those diverse backgrounds and make sure that's presented as well and contributing to the work that you do?
That is also a very interesting question. Inherently, the world's a better place. The more you meet people from different backgrounds, the more you travel and learn about different ways of seeing the world culture, it just relaxes you to feel good about change and difference. And I don't think there's enough celebration of difference anymore. Difference is seen as a negative, but actually it's a profoundly human thing that for some people change is scary, but differences are really, it's where the richness of humanity is that we've all got different ways of seeing the world. And that's on a tribal as well as a kind of individual or collective and individual level. But then there's also a lot of commonalities. You know, you talked about that at the head of our conversation, that we may come from very different backgrounds, but we'll share human commonalities. And if I travel in China, I go to Japan, I go to America, the language and the forms are potentially different, but I can see similar important similarities. It's a mix of those things. And then when you get people together, so more than half of our team's from a literally from a different country. So it's not just about ethnicity and demographics. It's about literal difference of people with different languages, backgrounds, ages, all sorts of different things. But it's also just mindsets. There's a big difference between somebody who went to university and somebody who didn't go to university. So social mobility is a thing as much as ethnicity or things like that. So we try and think of it in a very neutral way, which is we just like to have as open environment as possible for as many people to get into our industry as possible, because the industry is better because of that. In order to do that, we have a paid intern program. We've had it for a very long time, which is you have to literally invest in training people, because if they haven't had the ability to go to St. Martin's, then it's you have to train those basic skills to get them into the industry. You might have to get visas and bring them from different countries and help them get into the industry. Then when they're in the room, it's about share of voice. So there is a hierarchy to the company. Obviously, me being Dixon of Dixon Baxi, if I walk in the room, there's a different feeling to if one of the interns does. But the job, I think, when you're more senior, is to make yourself smaller, so that other voices can be heard. And if we're creating, if somebody is an intern 1 month into their journey and I'm 22 years into my journey in this company, the ideas are equal at the point of entry. And we do a lot of confidence building in sessions early on where people get used to talking to the team, sharing ideas, having a lot of equity and equal balance to how that works. And then the other part of it is trust, which is trust that people will make things, create things, do things, and deliver things in a way that will work, but not in the way that you work. So let them be the best version of themselves rather than a secondary version of you. So we try very hard to instill that. And it's not perfect, you know. Sometimes I bumble in the room and I'm too loud and I get in the way and it's annoying and may not have enthusiasm. You have to kind of keep reminding yourself to create space, but the team is very good at it. The interpersonal side of things, the way that the team looks after each other, protects each other, and trusts each other, I think is really good. I can see that they're helping each other get better creatively. And I don't just mean the designers, I mean the operational team, the producers, the strategists, the writers, everybody's part of that. The whole company is a creative entity. It's not designers plus. So yeah, that's sorry, a long-winded answer, but I think that's the answer.
Yeah, no, I love that. You're creating this culture of you're allowing this platform for people to feel like their ideas are valid, to feel like they are able to share. I think a lot of the time when people are in organizations, you know, they don't share because of fear of whether they're allowed to, whether it's their place to. And, you know, if you're not creating an atmosphere, a space where people can feel like they're being seen and heard and comfortable, that in itself is stifling their creativity and their ability.
And it's not that serious either. The problem we have is the world is too serious and the world is too negative. There's a lot of focus on things that are not working and mindsets around negativity, when actually the world is profoundly amazing and the ability to make things, share things, connect to the world, do things. It's never been a better time to have voice and make and do what we do. But there's this heavy baggage where everyone's throwing around a lot of negativity. So when we're in this building, whatever's going on in the world, everyone's safe here. Because the first thing you need to know is you need to know you're safe. Your job is safe. You can pay your mortgage or you pay your rent and you can look after your family or look after your dog or buy Cocoa Pops. You need the basic things sorting out. But then beyond that, you need to know that you have a place in the world. We're lucky that creativity validates who you are. It comes from the inside of you and it's an expression of who you are. So you need to get used to that feeling that that's not always perfect. Sometimes your work's shit and sometimes work is messy and sometimes it's not perfect. But that is literally the creative process. You don't press a button, whatever the software is, and magic comes out the other end. You have to fight to make great creativity. So you have to help people build a tolerance for that. And it's okay to make bad work before you make good work. And it's okay to make mistakes. If you make the same mistake 5 or 6 times, you're a bit of a turnip. But if you make one mistake and learn from it, it's a really powerful thing. It's the only way you can grow. So you have to have a high tolerance for that type of thing. And like I said, trust is a really important part of it, which is the world is quite complex, but creativity works better if you feel more confident and you have fun. So just goofing around, like messing around sometimes and taking the steam out of things is quite important. I mean, what we do is serious and it's deadline driven, so that makes it tricky. But we try very hard to, well, I certainly do, mess about as well as be serious.
Yeah, that in itself helps creativity to flow. I say this all the time with the students, as you know, you've got a couple of them now in your team.
And they're very good.
Shout out to Berenice and Prashant.
Prashant, yeah.
But, we're always saying to them that in order to be creative, it's not going to happen if you're sat at your desk in front of your laptop. Like, you have to get you have to change your state and give yourself the environment and the conditions to be able to produce, whether that's going outside for a walk, listening to music, picking up a book instead, having a conversation, just going somewhere different and having that pattern interrupt. That's how creativity comes. And we all know often our best ideas do not come when we're sat actually trying to figure out the thing it's when we're in the shower or brushing our teeth or having a cup. It's when we're doing something completely different to the actual work.
Exactly. It's also just giving yourself permission to do what you like to do rather than what other people tell you should do, because there's loads of ways of creating. And there's a lot of bullshit in the industry and stuff that says you should create a certain way, or you should be a niche, or you should be a generalist, or you should do this, you should do that. The truth is you can do what you want and you make a decision. We made a decision to be in a collective entity, a team, and we do it together. But what you don't need to do is worry about what other people are doing. So instead of spending hours and hours looking at other people's work and fear of missing out and the nervousness of like, I should be doing this, if you just switch all of that off for a period and go, I'd like to make this thing based on these terms, it gives you great power because you're much lighter in the way you do things. And of course, like a couple of weeks ago, we started a project. So we went to the Science Museum to kick that project off because it was good to get some input and reading books and all the things you talk about. But the truth is we're an aggregation of all the experiences we've ever had in any given moment. And as a creative person, when you start to make something, you don't have to literally go get inspiration that moment. You can use all the inspiration you've had for the 25 years of existed or 30 years of existed or whatever, and just go, I'm going to make this shit now. And I'm just going to, in an unqualified way, make something that I believe in. And all that stuff in your head will start to go, shh, and you'll make something.
Yeah.
If you try and qualify it, it disappears. So I think, often people overthink it, and it's not that complicated ultimately.
I have a habit of overthinking. I can be very analytical. Sometimes that's good, sometimes it's not so good. It just depends, because sometimes, as you say, you've just got to give it a go and get on with it and
It's
kind
what
of.
works. It's what works for you as well. Because, if you're analytical and you process that way, then it's important that you have space to do that. I'm a very visual person, well, naturally. I'm a designer by profession, but everyone says you've got to have sketchbooks and notebooks. I've never had a sketchbook and notebook. I don't take notes in meetings because I like to be present and look at the person in the face and talk to them and listen to them. And that's my way of processing. When I leave the room, the information I retain is how I create, whereas other people might sketch. So it really depends on the person. And I think that's the thing is within our team dynamic, even within our process, people are making and creating different ways. And if you can do that, that's what helps that the difference you're talking about come out. Because it's not just demographic or cultural or difference, it's actually literally how your brain works difference. So you've got to account for that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So talking of your the juniors and the graduates that come into Dixon Baxi, whether it's internships or as permanent members of staff, how do you continue then with this learning and development for them? Are there any particular programs or things that you do to help with that?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, there's a career journey in any given discipline, whether it's motion or design or strategy. You start out, and initially, you're supposed to be a sponge. You're supposed to learn, listen, you have low responsibility, and it's about learning the fundamentals of the craft and the discipline. And as you move up the layer cake, what happens is it becomes more collaborative. You take more responsibility. So then you ultimately are mentoring other people, but taking greater responsibility of your project. Then you're having a vision for the project and how other people work underneath that. And then you're having a vision for many projects and how people work under that. And then you're basically just, in a sense, managing that entity. And obviously, the further you go up, the less you hands-on create. So there's a kind of career journey, but the willingness to push yourself, learn, do new things, harness new technologies, take creative risks, they're the same the whole way along. So you're just adding different skills and experience in a sense to that process, and you can then shoulder a great amount of responsibility and work. And we've just actually the Essentials book is the first book. The second book is called Journeys, and for each discipline or department in the company, we've done an overview of what each role is, from the most junior to the most senior in each of the departments, and an overview of what we think mentorship and it's like, again, it's a consolidation of all the things we developed over the years. For that very reason, to give people a very linear path. And whenever, for example, we did a survey last year to see how people think, think where they are in the company and just see if we could find any blind spots. And the thing that came out the most was if they believe in the vision of the company and that shared endeavor, but have a clear view of where their career development's going. So, what's the next step after the one they're on? It makes them feel like they're progressing. And then outside of that, we have learning and development. So we have different companies like YCN and people like that we work with, where we have, paid relationships with them, where the team can dip into training or conferences or, video tutorials on specific things to help them develop skills.
That's awesome. That's great. Because I think when you ask people why they leave companies, often it's not because of the job, it's because they were doing in particular. It was often around progression or growth
Yeah,
or,
exactly. Yeah.
the team.
Same.
So it's super important. And the fact that people within the business understand the vision and feel like they're a part of it, I think is lovely.
And people, I mean, the truth is, if you have an agency, everyone's going to leave you. That's the truth. It's like one of the great, well, it's true. It's one of the great things about having an agency is you get to employ people, meet them, and be with them as part of their journey, and hopefully pass them on to the next people better than you receive them. And it's a really profoundly amazing thing. So we're talking about Berenice and Prashant, for example. I've only known them for a few months. But I love having them in the agency. I love their, along with the other junior designers like Jack and people, I love how they think and they bring something new to us. And I know they will develop and they have a home for as long as they want. But based on their lives and how they think and what they want to do, at some point they'll have to make a life decision. We've just had a producer, Elliot Levers, who's been with us for a number of years. and he's gone to another company to take a different arc in his career. And I'm really sad he's left because he's an awesome dude, but I'm also really excited to see what happens next in his career. And the idea you can part as friends and celebrate the successes you had together and then watch the future successes is kind of part of it.
Yeah.
And not everybody suits every organization either. I interview people all the time, like hundreds of people, and they'll come in and say, I'm working at this agency. They're terrible. They're so mean to me. And they're like doing all this stuff. And I'm like, well, I know those people. They're not like that.
Mm.
It's just, so when people leave companies, they have to find a way of leaving. It's difficult because it's you, not me, or me, not you, or whatever. So it's a difficult moment to make a decision to move on. It's hard for people. Because they're difficult decisions. I mean, some companies are great and some companies are great, but I think a lot of creative agencies are very good, but not every agency suits every type of person. I think it's important. The most important thing is to try and find that out before the person joins you rather than during.
That's tough.
Yeah, it's really hard. It's really hard. You know, the thing is that people need to interview us as much as we interview them. That's how I see it.
Yeah.
Culture is like a really fragile thing, and career development is a really fragile thing. But it's amazing the reasons that people give themselves for moving on. But as long as they're happy and they feel fulfilled and they're developing, then I think that's all that matters.
Yeah, especially the first one, happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, not about being miserable. I ain't got time for that.
No, life's too short. Life's too short. I mean, life can be hard. Life can be confusing and overwhelming at times, but we only get a short amount of time. So I think, I mean, I'm an eternal optimist, but I'm also a realist. So I try and balance those two things. But I'd rather look at things optimistically because I just enjoy things more. Mm. And I find it easier to deal with difficult things if I at least, I might rant and rave a bit now and again, but I try and tackle them with a kind of positive attitude because it's easier to deal with things if you do.
Yeah.
It's also easy to make decisions as well.
But that comes from mindset, doesn't it? And that's the start of everything. And when you were talking about the world being extremely negative and things being very serious, I mean, I've stopped watching the news, for example. I got to the point where I was like, I don't need to hear about this again.
Yeah, exactly.
I already know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And some people were very much, oh my gosh, you stopped watching the news. I'm like, yeah, like it's the same negative narrative. I can't impact it. It's not within my circle of influence. So why do I need to know? I'm going to find out anyway.
Well, the thing is, there's a difference between news and information.
Mm.
So what you get fed is the thing that they think will create the most churn and energy for what they're doing. But they'll quite quickly jump from one topic to another without ever saying, well, we decided not to talk about this anymore because we just believe you're going to click more and share more and share memes on this thing versus this thing. It's an agenda-driven thing as opposed to an information and benefit thing. And, you know, I think if you truly believe in something, then you can read about it and have the information without necessarily the froth and the energy of constantly being told everything's fucked. Yes, there's a lot of things that are bad in the world, but you can only control so many of them.
Mm.
And it's very easy to get mentally overwhelmed unless you somehow center into the things you can control, how you carry yourself and the way that you do what you do, or one does what they do. And then you make a judgment about what you put your energy into. So all of us will, I suppose, have things that we care about deeply. But the idea that every single person should care about every single thing at the same level that every other person does is just absurd. And the fact that I care about this and you care about that doesn't make me a bad person or you a bad person. It just means we look at the world differently. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, there's certain topics clearly that everybody should be on the right side of.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to, you know, enjoy listening to Donald Trump or Rishi Sunak talking about things because I don't believe in their moral compass. I will never vote for them and I'll avoid ever acting or, you know, carrying myself like them.
Yeah.
But I'll concentrate in an area where I can be helpful and beneficial to people. You know, so it's up to the individual, I think, to figure out. But in the world we're in creativity, we're looking to do something which is personally fulfilling. But the problem is it's because it's personal, criticism, uncertainty, the difficulty of making and, you know, the messiness of creativity, deadlines, interpersonal relationships also give you imposter syndrome and make you feel scared about the work you're doing. So you have to kind of balance those two things. When it's on, creativity as a profession is an amazing thing. You feel incredible. But the negativity and the worry and self-doubt can creep up on you. So you have to keep an eye on that, I think.
Yeah. And that can be difficult, especially when it's your business as well. You know, you've been running this business now, as you said, with your co-founder for 20 odd years. How do you navigate that? How do you build up that resilience to be able to deal with those situations, but also to motivate the team around you as well and kind of lead from the top?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. It's something I think about a lot about, actually. I try to lead from underneath, not the top. So I don't like top-down leadership. My feeling is that I work for the team and I work for the entity, not the other way around. And I create the space for people to create. Obviously, I'm a figurehead for the company. So looking after the business, you know, getting working, making sure the standards are met, protecting people. You know, if the grenade goes off, it's my job to jump on it. But outside of that, it's like shaping the environment for them to do what they do and trusting them to do it. There's two things that I do. I have a work side and a home side. They're different people. It's the same person inside. But at home, I'm much quieter, reserved. If you and I met, for example, at someone's house, I wouldn't be like this. I'd be much quieter, much more reserved. So when I come to work, I switch me on. It gives me a, I don't know, like a shield or some sort of protection. And because it is my entity, that helps as well, because I feel safe inside Dixon Baxi, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then I've also just figured I have no choice, in a sense, which is there's always a fork in the road, and you can look at the negative and the positive of that fork in the road. And I just rather look at the positive, even if it's something really hard like COVID or something. I just think, well, I have no choice now, based on the fact that COVID's happened, is to figure out how to survive this particular moment. So creativity is a great tool to problem solve. So why not do that and reduce the choices and the noise to as few things as possible? So I prioritize a lot. So I look at the thing that will have the biggest effect soonest, and I do the hardest thing first, and then I feel more relaxed.
I like that. That's cool.
Yeah. I get down or lost sometimes, and I get self-doubt like everybody else. I can get just as anxious as anyone. I mean, if you put me in a room with you or a client, obviously I can switch on. I appear confident and whatever. But inside, I have the same self-doubts everybody else does and get lost occasionally. But I think what it is I have huge, huge enthusiasm for creativity. It's like a flame inside me that, for whatever reason, it just is constant, that every single day I want to do a new thing and make things. If I hold on to that flame, everything else is easy.
That's amazing. I love that. You touched on COVID and navigating that. So many businesses, obviously, the whole world had to deal with that. And as you say, people either embraced the change and looked at that fork in the road and went, right, how am I going to pivot and make this work? Or went, oh my God, there's no way to make it work and didn't survive it. And since then, we've seen a real change in the landscape and the way in which we are working, and flexible working has really become a thing, as has remote working. You know, that's very much on the rise since COVID. I do wonder, especially with a lot of agencies that apply that have juniors coming in, that maybe aren't getting a lot of face-to-face contact like they would have in the past. How do you see that impact in the industry, and how do you see the future of kind of collaboration and creativity changing?
It's an interesting thing. I mean, your first point, the idea that remote working's on the rise, in a sense, it rose and then it plateaued. So whenever anything difficult happens to us, collectively, we overcorrect. So everybody was going to go live in Hawaii and the same salary you'd earn in San Francisco and work 3 days a week and surf the rest of it. Ooh. Unfortunately, life doesn't work like that. The reality is a life takeover. On top of that, humans are tribal. Why would you want to spend your entire life sat in your bedroom? Some people do, but lots of people don't. So what happens is the organizations settle into the places they want to do. What COVID promoted was a more flexible way of looking at working. We've always worked in lots of other countries, so we've worked remotely with clients for 2 decades. So the, you know, video conferencing stuff, all of that, that's always existed. But the ability for us to come together 3 days a week in the studio, but for people not to work on Mondays work at home on Mondays and work at home on Fridays and do a 4.5 day week instead of 5 days. Those things have helped the balance of culture. But of course, if you're somebody who has, say, high anxiety or likes to create a certain way, or you're an independent creator, whether you're an illustrator or painter or, a digital designer, and you want to work in your home or in your shed or a co-working space instead of being part of a team, then there is space to do that. It comes back to this same thing again, which is you have to pick and choose your battles. So for us, I like having an entity where I interact with people. I get more joy from it, and I think our work is better from it. In COVID, we were highly productive in terms of making things, but the quality of the work dips because you can't teach people as lucidly. And the last couple of weeks, we had a leak in our studio and it killed all of our power and blew our server up. So we had to go remote again for 2 weeks. You could feel a dip. You could feel a dip. So we like that. But I also appreciate other people and other organizations prefer to do it a different way. So I think it suits certain types of working, certain types of organizations. I think what will happen is because people are kind of tribal and the world is an interactive place, regardless of AI and all the various augmented ways of doing things, people will still want to interact in some way. Mm. But also there's now space for people to have time to themselves and privacy and navigate the world different ways. So I think it will end up being a balance.
Mm. I mean, COVID was a particularly challenging time.
Which was
what I was gonna talk about. How did you navigate that?
Well, there's a number of things. We've always been very pragmatic about how we look at the business side of things. So it's really important to me that the business is financially strong, and the business can operate when there's a recession as well as when there's a boom on. And we actually put money away. We have let's call it a rainy day fund. We don't know what that rainy day's form will take. But I've worked for 34 years now, and there's been more downtimes than uptimes in that 30-year period. You know, there's been all sorts of weird things have happened. So we have a financial rainy day bucket. So when something slams into us, COVID being the hardest thing I've ever been through professionally, we were financially secure than if we'd just been kind of spending all our money and doing stuff. So that buys you time. We also operate where there's margins to how you can operate as a business and how you make money. So we have a kind of break even, an ability to work at a lower level for a period. And that means we can go longer. So that helps protect us. On top of that, it's like a moral thing, which is we just after the first week said, whatever happens, we're going to get through this and we're not going to furlough anybody. We're going to protect everybody. We're going to hold the entity together and we'll figure it out. And then we just wrote a series of very simple plans in the kitchen and figured it out and stuck to the plan. And then just worked really, 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 really hard like everyone else did. Yeah. And there was all sorts of ups and downs. It's a bit surreal when I think back to it now. For me, it's about planning before the event happens. Because I've run a lot of agencies in lots of different parts of the world in difficult situations as well as really amazing boom times, we've built it so that if we get smacked, we can take several hits before it gets dangerous.
Yeah.
And the more you build a preventative environment, the better you can sustain when things are difficult. So I suppose that's the simplest answer.
Mm. It comes back to this resilience and this mindset, doesn't it? That you're really, it's cascading through every, you know, the more you talk, I'm just hearing about it more and more, which is amazing. Do you use that as well when you're working with clients? Like you've got an impressive list of clients, okay, on your roster, you know.
Thank you.
ITVX, AC Milan, Netflix, Channel 4. You know, when you think about all the things that you care about, your values, the way in which you work, Dixon Baxter being this safe space and all of that. How do you stay true to all of that and your creative vision whilst working with big, diverse brands?
It goes back to this thing of curating relationships. So say you were working with Nike and the person you worked with, you didn't have a creative fit with or you didn't share an ambition. It doesn't matter how great Nike is, you won't be able to do great work together. So we have lots of different opportunities that come towards us. People call us up, we talk to people. And you kind of, you know, cultivate relationships, you get referrals. So then you start to have conversations with them and you start to get a sense that you have a creative fit. So in the case of, say, let's say Channel 4, They have an internal team called Four Creative, who are highly, highly talented creative people who manage their brand. So we just had a very strong creative bond with them. So you go on that journey together, so you end up being a co-bonded team. You're obviously working for Channel 4, but you're also working with their team. So we look at the relationships with the people rather than the brand. And if you get a good cultural fit, you know, Google operates very, very differently to ITV, and ITV is incredibly different to AC Milan. And again, that's one of the joys, because every time you do a new project, you spend a long time immersing in that and learning about the culture of that organization, the audiences and the fans that they serve, where they are in the world, what's important to people. And that's one of the joys of the job, really, is, you know, when I'm in Italy drinking coffee with the AC Milan client and then going to the stadium and meeting fans who've been there for 2 hours before the game and whipped in a frenzy. But then you go to Halifax and talk to somebody in a chip shop about ITV and I'm a celebrity. Then you go to, I don't know, America and talk to somebody about how they download something onto a phone. And we did a, you know, bank, a fintech and a real world bank in the Philippines recently. And that was aimed at people who didn't have bank accounts. So those things are the things that become important. It's the audience that's important. We're designing for the people that we design for, not the client. Mm-hmm. And if everyone focuses on that, it's much easier for everyone to get along. The reality is, though, you have to have flexibility. So there's a lot of conversation in the industry about clients getting in the way. Oh, they made me do this and they changed my work and they're like, what, they don't know what they're doing. Those people must have the wrong client, because all great work is sponsored by clients. So all the D&AD black pencil winning work and all the things we see people winning and all the stuff we see online that we love, they're all sponsored by clients. So what you want to do is find a good creative fit. That means that you they can get the best of you, but also respecting that when they say something to you, that there is more than one way of looking at answering the problem and you're doing it together. And having that balance, I think, helps as well.
Yeah, absolutely. When you said then it's not about the brand, it's about the audience and relationships. And
yeah.
I think that's the thing that sometimes people miss, that it's about relationships. It's not, I know we hear about, you know, B2C and B2B and all this, but actually it's H2H, isn't it? It's human to human. It's about finding ways to connect with people, to create meaningful work that's impactful, that solves problems, mm-hmm. and that collectively we're working towards hopefully the same goal.
Yeah, exactly. And don't forget, you know, clients, you know, based on the level of work we do, the client that is our sponsor has a huge responsibility. You know, those jobs are terrifying. They're really hard to do. So you have to understand that they're in a position where they're concerned about their role in the company, and like it has to be successful for real. But you know, so that process where the internal team buy into it is really important, because that's their jobs. They're living that every day and they understand the brand. So we're kind of facilitating something that makes them feel proud about the company and vice versa. You're designing for the audience. You're designing for their business relationships or the industry or investors. There's lots of different audiences. But the idea is that there should be value to all of them. But if everybody feels that the benefit and value of the change and what you're doing, then everybody wins and you do something which is worthwhile. It's not easy, but if it was easy, everybody would be doing it.
Exactly. There's a lot of talk at the minute. I'm in quite a few WhatsApp chats with other creatives and designers and business owners. And as much as I say, I don't watch the news, but I am very aware of what's going on and you know, I am informed. And there's a real feeling of uncertainty at the minute, especially within the creative industry and a lot of these young aspiring creatives that are coming in that want to make an impact and want to get into the industry. I feel like what I'm seeing is a lot of them are being, to some degree, let down. You know, there's a lack of opportunity and sometimes a lack of support, and a lot of them are being asked for experience that they haven't had the opportunity to undergo. What are your thoughts on that, and what advice would you give to?
No, I've heard that a lot, that thing about being asked for experience they don't have. Yeah. I don't have experience that, because it's not something we ask for. So I'm not sure how real that is. There's a difficulty to some of the language there, which they're being let down. I think what that's doing is laying the kind of problem at industry's feet and the people who are hiring people. But in my experience, I get contacted by thousands of people a year it's like a pyramid. There's people at the bottom who are just plain lazy or ill-informed and just don't make an effort. And then there's people who kind of make a bit of an effort, but they're not doing too much. Then there's people who really think a little bit and they've got a perception of what they want to be. Then there's people who've got a perception of what they want to be, but also understand that it's a relationship. It's a two-way thing. So they're talking to somebody. It's not an abstract thing. And then there's the people who really take that on board. And they're the ones who are successful because they see both sides of it. And it's a kind of empathetic relationship. And they put the effort in to stand out. Most people drive by and they throw their folio digitally, like throwing it through someone's window, and they go, why the hell didn't they look at my folio? It's because you just threw it from my window. Someone sent me a message just an hour before you and I got on. It was to Ann Walsh, not Dixon Baxey. So they just copied the same thing and forgotten to change the name.
I mean, that's good.
It was written in a really generic way, and they'd not asked permission to send the files, and it was just really heavy-handed. But then yesterday, somebody contacted me, a young designer, wrote a really beautiful, lucid note, talked a lot about creativity, talked about why his creativity would match our creativity, talked about some projects, asked permission to share his work, and I'm going to have a coffee with that person. So it's a mutual thing. I think when you think about, from my perspective, our job is to, we try and share as much knowledge as we can and be open source, and I try to answer as many questions or show up as much as I can for people. But I only do it if there's a mutual respect. If somebody just demands something or doesn't put the effort in, then they don't deserve the relationship. And I think there is a tension between education and the industry where education is teaching people great creativity, but also there is a perception that everybody should have everything and should have it easily. When I entered the industry, it was really hard to get into it. And it's always hard to get into. And to get to expect everybody to be able to work at Dixon Baxey or to work at Collins or to work at Netflix, it doesn't work like that. So you have to figure out what that journey is. You can't suddenly accelerate to the top. You have to figure things out. So I think it's just it's a bit of a reality check. And I think the industry has just got to be more open and honest about how that process works. Somebody was telling me the other day that people have been asked to do work to, you know, to show that they could do it on a role, an interview. So that kind of thing is like it's profoundly terrible. So I think there's a responsibility from our perspective to make access as easy as possible to everybody. But reciprocally, people have to not just send 50 folios out by changing the name on and hope that people will pick it up because they just won't.
Yeah, I did a talk yesterday at my old stomping ground at the time of recording this. I went to Staffordshire University, hadn't been there for 13, 14 years. Spoke to the students about branding and the working world and my journey. And some of the things I talked about was the fact that it's not going to be easy, so don't expect it to be. Expect the knockbacks, expect the failures. You know, I was in their very position 14 years ago, and I remember sending out a portfolio and tailoring my portfolio to each individual organisation and tailoring my covering letter and doing that over the summer. And I said, and I must have sent out maybe 100 emails. And I said, and it was so disheartening, you know, not necessarily getting a reply back and wondering if I was making any leeway. And I said, but, you know, I did eventually because I persisted. And and you do have to keep kind of plugging away and doing things, and experience was something that I knew that I'd needed. So I went and did some volunteer work in the medical illustration department at a hospital near me, you know, working with the in-house team then. So by the time I got to applying for jobs and things, I had experience. Yes, it was volunteer work, but I had it. So
but even so, what you've done is you've taken responsibility for the process.
Yeah.
And there's a positivity and there's an energy to that people can feel. My business partner, Apoorva, when he entered the industry, he hand-delivered letters and work. He just went around London and knocked on the front door of agencies and hand-delivered it, literally, to find an internship. And from that internship, he and I met each other. When I started out, I started out when I was 19 and I was at college, and it wasn't a particularly good course, but I started an agency rather than going into industry with two people. And I did three other jobs as well as the agency. So I did cleaning jobs and all sorts of horrible things. But I did that while I had no money so that I could make the work I wanted in order to get what I wanted. And it took about 18 months before I started getting to the point where I could pay myself. So there's different ways you can choose to do that. But I think what you're describing, persistence and not being down about rejection, because you've got to understand it works both ways, which is if we say, let's say there's 50 of us here, we might have 2 or 3 roles a year, maybe more. So we're currently hiring 3 or 4 roles, but we might get 2,000 people apply for that. So we can only interview so many people and we can only interact with so many people. So we're not ghosting anybody. We're not ignoring anybody. But the maths say that it's impossible to speak to 1,000 people. Yeah. So you have to find out a system for that. And it's not perfect and it's very difficult. And we try our very best to do the right thing. And I'm sure other agencies do. Maybe some don't. But there is a reality to how life works. So I think the more you take control of your own version of that, and level the portfolio up, level the work up, level the perspective, you know, your personality and the way you see creativity, and share that with people and have a good social feed, turn up at events, meet people, be persistent, the more likely you are to be successful. If you just email 100 agencies a portfolio and then sit and wait, it just won't happen. I mean, it does occasionally, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's an active endeavor. And I mean, I would say, you know, I get rejected all the time, even now. You know, so we're constantly trying to develop relationships and get work from clients, which is, it's not like getting a job, but it's a similar thing. But even with all my experience and pedigree and the work that I bring to bear, I still get rejected or ignored all the time.
I appreciate that honesty. I'm sure the listeners will as well.
I mean, obviously some people listen to me, otherwise we'd have no work. But it's not easy. And I have great sympathy for people because it's really hard and it's so easy for self-doubt to creep in. But I think the only way of solving that is taking charge and making things and trying things. And what you described, I think, is really actually the answer. It's the simplest way of putting it.
Yeah. Try and look at what you can control.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how I look at things. I go, okay, this is where I am. This is the situation.
Mm-hmm.
What can I do? What's in my control to try and improve it? And there's always something.
But you radiate that. That's the thing is when I talk to you, I can feel that. I can feel the fact that you do that. And I can imagine you've done that ever since you entered the industry. And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because you're, in a sense, you're making your own luck because you're adding, you're being positive, you're active. And people can feel that. They can totally feel it. And that's why, you know, nobody is like an overnight success. There's always like little stories like the ones you described. You go, oh, that's why they're successful. You know, yeah. They brought something to the table and they were positive and additive and helpful and, you know, different and interesting or whatever the thing is.
Thanks, Simon. Appreciate that.
You're welcome.
So looking ahead then, what's on the horizon? You know, because two decades in, what have you got going on that's exciting? What initiatives are happening? What can we expect for Dixon Baxi?
Well, I suppose there's a number of things. The first thing is the essential thing we're doing is, in a sense, putting a foundation under, re-laying the foundations of what we believe in. So that's really good for our culture, I think. We're working on a project called Super Futures, which is basically a series of books and a digital project, which it came out of doing a retrospective book. And it was supposed to celebrate our 20th birthday, but with COVID and various things, that never happened. It wasn't the right time. But it's turned into, instead of it being a retrospective of our work, what we're doing is looking at it like a new operating system, a new way of looking at how we create and how we use new technologies and applied intelligence and look at different ways of working. And we're making new work based on existing projects or remixing them and looking at futuring projects and looking at the kind of raison d'etre of the organization. And we're making a 3-book set, which will then be a very comprehensive, interactive digital experience. And we'll release that probably sometime early next year. But it's changing how we look at, we went out of the door there. If you ever come to London, I can show you. If you went out there, the wall is full of our work remixed on new ideas around how we create. So that is the thing that's most important, is reinventing how we we create, and then we'll share that with the world. We'll probably share a version of Essentials. We'll make just make that open source for people. And then the eternal thing is doing work that makes us excited, because we've always had this thing is we'd rather be better than bigger, or we'd rather be the size that allows us to do the work we want rather than it being about a certain size of company. So it's how it feels to make the work and make the work we want to. So that's the thing is that, you know, the thing I described, that feeling of what it feels like to make the work. So we're spending a lot of time looking at that. And if we went outside the door, you'd see that that's going quite well.
Oh, awesome. That does sound exciting. Remixing. Well, this has been great. Thank you so much. I've just looked at the time.
Yeah, sorry. I've been blathering on. I apologize.
No, not at all. Like, I've loved speaking to you today, and the conversation's just flowed. I'm sure our listeners will have enjoyed it too. So, yeah, thank you for, you know, spending your time with us. Just thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. Well, thanks for being a wonderful host. I've really enjoyed the conversation. I thought I would do. I knew it'd be nice to talk to you, because you can kind of tell. But, I've really enjoyed it. These things can be a little bit torturous sometimes. So it's quite nice to do one which is a bit more relaxed and about things that are more meaningful. So thanks for taking the time to chat to me. Thanks for inviting me. It's really nice of you. I do appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Build Better Brands. I am so grateful to have you tuning into the show, and I'd love to thank you personally. So wherever you are in the world, remember to tag at Danielle Clark Creative in your social media posts and stories. Let us know when you're listening. You want to know what you've enjoyed about the show and give you a shout out. And if you would like to help more people like you discover the show, please subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes. It's going to help us rank higher and reach more listeners. It's also a great way for us to help you with the problems your brand might be facing. Suggest a topic in your review and we might feature it and you in one of our episodes. Thanks again for listening. See you next time.